Mark Holtz, and you're listening to Looking Up with Don. This is the Looking Up with Don podcast, episode 7, for the week of February 19th, 2020. The related website for this podcast is donmacholtz.com. That is spelled donmacholz.com, two H's. So, what's up in the sky this week? As our week begins on Wednesday, February 19th, the moon is in the morning sky moving just south of the planet Jupiter. Now, as we discussed last week, this is a good opportunity to go out and find the moon on the 19th in the daytime and then hop over for a daylight observation of the planet Jupiter. A few days later, on Sunday, February 23rd, the moon will be new, passing just south of the sun. Then next week, Wednesday the 26th and Thursday the 27th, the moon will pass by Venus in the evening sky. But that will be in next week's podcast. In the evening this week, the planet Venus is in the southwest. Now, everyone is familiar with the fact that the sun casts your shadow, and the moon does too. But did you know that the planet Venus is bright enough to cast a shadow too? That's what we're going to try this week when Venus is at magnitude minus 4.2. And we're going to try it again in March and April when Venus is even brighter. Technically, Venus casts a shadow whether you can see it or not, but we're going to try to see the shadow. Now, this is how I have done it, and I was outside last night, and I was able to see the shadow cast by Venus. Go outside as the sky is getting completely dark. When it's about 90 minutes after sunset, find a dark place where you can see the planet Venus in the west. Let your eyes get adapted to the darkness. This might take a few minutes. Then hold up a sheet of white paper a foot or so from your eyes, and looking at the paper, slowly wave your hand with your fingers spread apart between the paper and Venus as if you're waving at Venus. Look very carefully for pattern changes on the paper. It will be subtle. What you are looking for is the shadow of your hand on the paper. Since Venus is a very tiny light source, the shadow of your hand will be a sharp shadow with very distinct edges. Try this for a few minutes. If you fail to see the shadow, don't worry. We'll try this again next month when Venus is even brighter. And once more in the evening, go out and take a look at Betelgeuse. It is still dim. I saw it at magnitude 1.6 this week, but what do you think? Use Star Map 1 for Podcast 7 to make an estimate of the brightness of Betelgeuse. And remember, the smaller the number, the brighter the magnitude. For instance, 1.5 is brighter than 1.7. One theory is that it will begin to brighten soon. Another theory I've heard recently is that the reason it's dimming is not because the star is getting dimmer, but that there is dust and gas between us and the star, and that makes the star appear dimmer. Our three brightest planets are stacking up in the morning sky. Mars is retrograding as it's headed toward the planet Jupiter, and they'll be closest on March 20, which is a month away. You might want to take a few minutes and get a good look at Jupiter through the telescope. Word has come out in the last couple days that the southern band of Jupiter is beginning to get thinner. Now, Jupiter has two main bands, one north of the equator and one south of the equator. The one that is south of the equator is where the great red spot is. So take a look at Jupiter and see for yourself if the bands are the same width or is the one in the southern hemisphere thinner. And last week when we went out in the evening, we looked at the Milky Way that runs across the winter sky. This week, go out in the morning, about 2 hours before sunrise, and view the summer Milky Way extending from north to south across the eastern sky. Our comet for this week is Comet Pan-STARRS, C2017T2. It is the brightest comet in our sky, and currently it's about magnitude 9. It's still in our evening sky, and now would be a good time to get out and see it with your telescope, but you will need a telescope to see it. Its path is marked on Star Map 2 from Podcast 7. The International Space Station is visible in the morning sky to those in the northern hemisphere this week. For those in the southern hemisphere, it will be visible in the evening sky. Those near the equator will most likely not see the International Space Station at all after this weekend. You'll have to wait about another week to see it. To find out where it will be in your sky, go to the website heavens-above.com, enter your location, and find out where and when to see it, then go out and look up. We're now at some of the coldest nights of winter, so let's look at some hot stars. This week we'll take a look at the Pleiades, also known as the Seven Sisters, and in the Charles Messier catalog, it's number 45, so it's often referred to as M45. Now, these evenings, it's high in your western sky, a couple hours after sunset. We'll be looking at it with the unaided eye, binoculars, and a telescope. The Pleiades is an open star cluster, and it's about 440 light years away. Now, this cluster is large, covering 17 light years in diameter, and in our sky, that measures about 1.5 degrees across. These stars are hot stars, much hotter, brighter, and larger than our sun. They're also blue in color. Most of these stars formed within the last 100 million years. Now, sometimes when people see the Pleiades, they say, "Oh, that's the Little Dipper." Well, it looks like a Little Dipper, but it is not the Little Dipper. Now, this is not just an open star cluster, but there's also some faint nebulosity involved with this cluster. This is caused by dust that reflects some of the starlight. Now, the dust is not left over from dust from the formation of the cluster, but the cluster appears to be drifting through a cloud of dust. So our unaided eye challenge this week is to go out and look at the Pleiades. Refer to Star Map 1 of Podcast 7 to locate this open cluster. Take a few minutes for your eyes to become dark adapted. The Seven Sisters are called the Seven Sisters because apparently there are seven stars visible to the unaided eye. How many do you see? Many people see only six, some see seven, some see eight or more. It depends upon your eyes and the skies. Seeing six stars is fairly easy. Seeing seven is much harder, yet this is called the Seven Sisters. Why is that? Maybe it depends upon the star's brightness. Could one or more of the stars been brighter in the past? Or did people have better eyes or better skies so they more easily saw seven stars? Or was it named the Seven Sisters to better fit the mythological story when only six stars were visible? Now for the nebulosity. I recall that once the late Walter Scott Houston, who wrote a widely popular monthly column called Deep Sky Wonders, which appeared each month in Sky and Telescope, told me that he suspected the nebulosity in M45 could be detected with the unaided eye. But this suggestion of his did not get past the editors, so it was never published. So what do you think? Can you see any nebulosity around the stars of M45? The brightest portion of the nebulosity is located around the southernmost star of the cluster. For our binocular challenge, let's get our binoculars on M45. You'll see more than the seven main stars, as fainter stars are both immersed in the star pattern and spilling beyond the star pattern. Now, all of these are cluster-based stars, blue stars and hot stars. You might notice why unaided star counts of this cluster are difficult. Some of the stars are close to each other, so to have a high star count with the unaided eye, you need to not just have good light grasp, but good acuity with your eyes, that is a sharpness of vision. Near the middle of this tiny bowl, you might see one of my favorite parts of this cluster, a wide double star system. Through binoculars, it might not look very wide. You have to hold the binoculars very steady and look for it. The two stars are magnitude 8.3 and 8.4, and they're separated by only 42 arc seconds. I've always seen this double star system as a stark contrast to the brighter, well-separated stars surrounding them. Now, with your binoculars, look for nebulosity. At first, you might think that your optics are fogged or dirty or that the sky has haze or fog. If they aren't, you're seeing the nebulosity. How cool is that? The fact that you're using two eyes with binoculars rather than one eye with a telescope helps to increase the contrast. Now, if you have a telescope, let's take our telescopes out and look at M45. Wide field works best. At least it will give you a good view of most or all of the cluster. Look for the nebulosity with a wide field eyepiece, and then increase the magnification to decrease the field of view, and move the bright stars just out of the field. Then look for nebulosity. And don't forget that double star near the center. Fun fact. Last week I discussed the three factors that must be met to visually discover a comet. Now, this is a theory I developed in the late 1970s as I was comet hunting. To review, the three factors are, 1, position, you must be looking at the comet. 2, brightness, the comet must be bright enough for you to see it. And 3, timing, you must find it before others. So some further discussion on this. This past week, I was rewriting my comet discovery story for my 8th comet, a periodic comet that I discovered on August 13, 1994, with my 10-inch reflector. I researched if I could have found the comet earlier and why it wasn't discovered sooner. My notes show that I swept the area just north of the comet 8 days before I eventually found it. And at that time, the comet was in the constellation Cassiopeia, less than a degree south of the bright star Delta in Cassiopeia. The position of the comet that morning is rather important. Its declination was 59.5 degrees, 59.5. I was sweeping north of this area from 60 degrees to 90 degrees declination. So if I stuck just to those locations, I would have missed the comet by 0.5 degree. But usually I overspill the declination, meaning I'll sometimes sweep as far south as 58 degrees. If that's true, then I swept over the comet without seeing it. Why did I miss it? Well, perhaps the glare of the bright star drowned out the comet, or maybe the comet was still rather faint, and it outburst a few days later and prior to my discovery of it 8 mornings later. Then, on the next morning, August 6, I swept the area south of the comet's position, but the comet had now moved northward to a declination of 60.6 degrees. My sweeps were between the declination of plus 20 to plus 60, meaning that if I stuck within those limits, I would not have swept far enough to pick up the comet. But once again, I probably had about a 1 or 2 degree overspill, so I suspect I swept as far north as 62 degrees. Therefore, I probably swept over the comet without picking it up. Now, we can't blame the star's glare this time, as a comet had moved more than a degree away from the star. Could it be that the comet was simply too faint for me to pick up both this morning and the previous morning? That's probably the case, as this comet had an outburst a week after I discovered it and had fragmented over time. One could now suspect that it had outburst before I discovered it a week later. One more bit of evidence. In 1979, 15 years before this time, and three orbits prior, this comet, of course, was still undiscovered, and it was moving through our evening sky in winter of 78 into early 1979. And at that passage, it was fairly close to Earth, about 25 million miles. It should have been fairly bright, up to eighth magnitude bright at its brightest, and yet nobody picked it up. I did a review of the areas that I covered in late 1978 and early 1979, and I see that on three occasions, I swept right over the position of the comet without picking it up. So I'm thinking, how could I be so blind? I was at the right place. I was long before it was discovered, yet I did not pick up the comet because apparently it was too faint. The suspicion now is that periodic comet Machholz 2, also known as P/141, does vary in brightness. When I picked it up in 1994, it had split into several parts, and it probably outburst shortly before I discovered it on August 13th of 94. So the previous visits to the vicinity of the Earth, it comes by every 5 years, it probably had not brightened much and stayed fairly dormant, so no one picked it up every time it came by. So there's a couple lessons to be learned here. In the course of the 24 hours that I swept on August 5th and 6th in 1994, the comet moved from 59.5 degrees to 60.6 degrees declination, crossing the boundary that I use for my comet hunting areas, which is at 60 degrees north declination. It just so happened that when I covered the area north of that line, the comet was just south of it. And the next morning, when I covered the area south of that line, the comet had moved north of it. If I had not overspilled or overlapped beyond that boundary, I would not have found the comet, no matter how bright it was. So it always pays to sweep an area slightly larger than your boundaries to cover those comets moving from one area to another. Another lesson is that you can satisfy two of those factors, in this case being at the right location and at the right time, that is, before it was discovered, and still not see the comet if it's too faint. After I discovered my fourth comet, I realized that I was finding some strange comets. Of the 44 comets visually discovered since I began comet hunting on January 1, 1975, the comets with the closest perihelion, that is, their closest approach to the sun, were all discovered by me. And after all these years, since 1975, of the 94 comets discovered since January 1, 1975, those three comets are still those with the shortest perihelion distance. Meanwhile, other comet hunters were finding comets in less search time than I had, and they were fainter than the comets I was finding. They were also finding them in the evening sky while I wasn't. Well, part of the reason that I wasn't finding any in the evening sky is that I was spending about 70% of my time searching in the morning. Nevertheless, this still holds true, and all 12 of my comet discoveries have been found in the morning sky. All told, by my fourth comet discovery in 1988, 26 comets were found in the morning sky and 18 in the evening sky. Also, those found in the morning sky averaged magnitude 8.8 at discovery, while the average discovery magnitude of those found in the evening sky was more than a magnitude fainter at 9.9. Comets found in the morning sky also had a shorter average perihelion distance, 0.79 astronomical units, compared to 0.94 of those found in the evening sky. Finally, comets found in the morning sky had a 30% greater chance of being in a retrograde orbit than those found in the evening sky. I soon realized that this was because of the various equipment and comet hunting programs used by us comet hunters. Now, a little bit of history. I first began comet hunting with a 4.25-inch reflector. Within 10 months, I graduated to a 10-inch reflector. At that time, in late 1975, a 10-inch telescope for comet hunting was considered to be a large telescope, but that didn't last very long. As early as 1978, the late Rolf Meyer of Canada, and later David Levy of Arizona, and Howard Brewington of New Mexico were using 16-inch reflectors for comet hunting. By the mid-1980s, Casimiras Cernus was using a 19-inch telescope. They could see about a magnitude fainter than I could. So I saw that us comet hunters were divided into two groups. Group one, of which I was a part, along with most of the Japanese comet hunters, used small aperture instruments, covered mostly the morning sky, and swept the sky frequently. Type 2 used larger instruments, covered much of the evening sky, and discovered comets at a magnitude fainter than those of us who are Type 1. Examining these discoveries, and combining morning and evening, and just sorting the discoveries of those found with apertures greater than 10 inches with those who used instruments of 10 inches and smaller, those with the larger instruments were discovering comets 2 magnitudes fainter than those with the smaller instruments. Also, those with the larger instruments found comets in about half the number of search hours as those of us with the smaller instruments. So, why was I finding unusual comets? I was using a wide field of view with a relatively small aperture, and I did frequent sweeping. I put myself in the position to find comets that were brightening rapidly as they were heading for a close approach to the sun. Now, you see, the closer a comet will go to the sun, the faster it moves in space and the faster it brightens. So I might cover an area and miss a comet because it was too faint, but 2 weeks later, I'd cover the same area and find the comet after it had brightened a bit. Visual comet hunting is different now from what it was in the 1970s and 1980s. Nowadays, automated search programs electronically image the sky nightly, and they see much fainter than what a visual comet hunter can do. As a result, most visual comet hunters no longer search. Some have gone into imaging the sky for comets with cameras or CCDs, while most have retired from comet hunting completely. Probably fewer than a half a dozen individuals systematically hunt for comets visually. You could say that the rest are laughing at us, saying, "Why are you still searching for comets? Everybody knows they can't be found visually anymore." Visual comet hunting began around the time of Charles Messier in the mid-1700s, and now after 270 years, it is coming to an end. In future podcasts, beginning in a few months, we'll trace the history of visual comet hunting. Now for fun with the marathon. The Messier Marathon is a yearly activity to observe all or nearly all of the 110 galaxies, clusters, and nebula in the Messier catalog in one night. The best time to do this is in late March of each year, and it does depend upon the moon phase. This year, the new moon is on March 24th, which is the ideal time. Most astronomy clubs will be doing this on either the 21st or the 28th of March. Now, those dates are chosen because they are Saturday nights, and astronomy clubs often choose Saturday nights for both their public and private star parties. You, individually, can do the Messier Marathon on both dates, which are Saturday nights, and on all the nights in between. I've done many Messe marathons on weekday nights. To successfully run the marathon, it helps to have an observing order. You can download one from my website. It's Podcast 5, MM Search Sequence. You might also want to download Podcast 7, Map 3, MM 3, which shows the Messe objects that we'll be discussing this week. I don't know about you, but I get out and practice finding the Messe objects before I do the Messe marathon. Now, these are like mini marathon nights, perhaps an hour or two poking around and finding the Messe objects. This helps me to get back into shape for the Messe marathon. At this time of year, you can go out as the sky darkens and search the first few groups of objects while they're still high in the western sky. A more realistic simulation would be to wait about 3 hours until the objects are lower in the sky, as they would be in late March. This is good practice for locating them under similar conditions for the marathon, lacking only the slight twilight glow you'll have on the Messe marathon evening in March. One exercise is to find the most difficult object in the evening sky, M74, and then watch it as it sinks toward the horizon. How low can you go with M74? Can you see it when it's 10 degrees high? How about 5 degrees high? And after you lose that object down by the horizon, go after M33 and M110, the next two most difficult evening objects. When we left off last week, we had seen the second set of Messe objects in the Messe Marathon. And altogether, we've covered 25% of the 110 objects in the evening sky. This week, we're covering 20 more objects. Lately, we've seen a lot of open clusters and nebula in the winter Milky Way. Now we head over to the galaxies. LEO, 5 objects. Let's begin with M95 and M96. Both are diffuse with fairly low surface brightness. Then move nearly a degree north for another galaxy, M105. Now, nearby M105 is another galaxy that's slightly fainter. It's NGC 3384, and it is not a Messe object. Next, we're going to head over to M65 and M66. If you look about a half a degree north of M66, you'll see the fainter galaxy, NGC 3628. Now we're going to head north and cover stuff by the Big Dipper. We start with M81 and M82. Then we work over to the bowl of the Dipper. In the bowl of the Dipper, we'll pick up the planetary nebula M97 and then head nearly a degree northwest to the galaxy known as M108. Then we go to the next bright star in the Big Dipper and pick up M109. Now we go to the next bright star in the Big Dipper and we pick up the double star M40. From here you go 11 degrees south for the galaxy M106. Three more galaxies are below this location. There are M94, M63, and M51. Next, we're going to move north again near the handle of the Big Dipper and get M101. And then about an hour of right ascension further toward the east to pick up a galaxy known as M102, which is taken to be NGC 5866. In late March at about 9 or 10 p.m., you're working your way down toward the northeastern horizon by now. Finally, we head south again for globular cluster M53, galaxy M64, and finally, the globular cluster M3. That should be fairly low in your eastern sky. Now we've just finished 20 more Messe objects. Altogether, we've done 48 of the 110 objects. I was out last night practicing for the marathon, and I saw 45 of these objects in about 50 minutes. So if you have found all the Messe objects we've talked about in these last three podcasts, you've seen 43% of the Messier catalog. Next week, we're going to go through all those galaxies in Virgo. And believe me, it's not as hard as you might fear. Last call for this, for those of you in the Phoenix area, on this Friday, February 21st, I'll be delivering a lecture on the Messe Marathon to the East Valley Astronomy Club. Go to their website, evaconline.org, for details. Everybody's invited, and it's on Friday evening, February 21st. The website is evaconline.org. You have been listening to Looking Up with Don, podcast episode 7. Once again, the related website for this podcast, where you can download all these star maps and search sequences for free, is donmachholz.com. That is spelled donmachholz.com. Two H's. God willing and pod willing, I'll be back next week for another episode of Looking Up with Don. We will discuss what's going on in the sky. We'll cover more of the Messe Marathon search sequence, where we'll be discussing those confusing galaxies in Virgo, and I'll be discussing why in the world we have leap year. Thank you for listening. See the sky this week. I'll see you next week.